Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. A couple of months ago, a very tragic thing happened. We lost a great innovator in our industry in terms of electronics. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the innovative things that he invented and designed. Aspen Pittman, and most people know him for Groove Tubes, but he did a lot more than that. And a couple of years ago, we were trying to get him on the show, and at that time, I think it was the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, the other show that I did, and Lonnie from the LA Amp Show, who's here tonight, he introduced me to Aspen. It's like, you got to get this guy on the show, and it never happened because the schedules were, we just couldn't get it together. But tonight, what I want to do is I want to kind of just reminisce a little bit, talk about some of the things that he did, because he's a significant person in terms of, as a guitar player, how we use our instruments, our amps, and he did some really innovative things. So I invited a bunch of people down, and thanks, Lonnie, for help putting this together. I'm going to go right down the line and just introduce everybody, then we'll start talking about their involvement and how they knew Aspen. First of all, Paul Fingers, an amazing guitar player, and stay tuned for him. I'm going to have him on the show. Now that he's here, I snooker him into a date. Jonathan Eric Wilson, who also worked with Aspen. Everybody knows Lonnie from the Amp Show, which is coming up in 2 weekends, I think.
2 weekends.
Yeah. 2 weekends. And Don Butler, who's been on the show several times and also worked with him, and hiding behind, I don't think he's on camera, Doug is here.
What about Tone Man?
There he is.
Tone Man.
Well, no, Don. I know him as Don.
Tone Man.
Sorry. Tone Man. Let me write that down. But anyway, welcome, guys. It's really great to have you here, and thank you for coming down to pay tribute to Aspen. So I'm just going to go down the line. Who wants to go first? Do you want me to just take it across?
No, just go.
All right, Paul, you take it away and tell us a little bit of how you met Aspen, and because you've done some interesting stuff too, innovative stuff. But
I'm a guy born and raised here, mm-hmm. guitar player, toured with my wife for 22 years in our band. In 1979. I went to the NAMM show, saw this guy, big guy, with a bunch of cool old amps sitting there, and walked into his booth, and he was talking to a guitar player, and of course I was young, and mm-hmm. It was Jeff Baxter, and I was like,
oh wow,
I'm going like, oh my god, this guy's incredible, he's talking to Jeff Baxter, it's Jeff Baxter, and he finishes with Jeff, and what impressed me the most was that he treated me he didn't know I was watching, he treated me exactly the same way that he treated Jeff. So we start talking about stuff. He goes, well, what do you play? You know, Rocky Blues, you know, like everybody else. And, what kind of amps do you have? He says. And I said, well, I have two Blackface Super Reverbs and I have an orange 120-watt stack. And he looks at me and goes, you have an orange stack? Nobody here on the West Coast plays orange amps. And I said, well, that's me. Well, that's pretty cool. And then he goes, where do you live? And I said, I live in Sylmar. And he's like, I live in Sylmar. And that was the starting of a long friendship. He was truly a guy, and every one of these guys will tell you, give you the shirt off his back.
Yeah.
The nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. Too many people are jealous of his success or his ideas or whatever, but Aspen was godfather to my son.
Oh, wow.
So he who just is going to have a baby soon, so he's not going to get to meet the baby, but Aspen said, well, why don't you come over to the house? Went up to the house, and we hit it off. We became really good friends. He came out to see our band so many times. He was like a regular. He was like a groupie. But he was always bringing stuff and calling me to the house, going like, you have to take this so that you can play this. And I'm doing this. And so he kind of had me come over, and I would go and test tubes for him. And my wife was the initiator of what was called the House of Pain.
Yep.
Which was the room we used to test preamp tubes, and they'd have to turn up really loud and test the tubes to see if it would feed back or not. And little by little, finally, he said one day, after all the years of working with him, he said, you're gonna have to have children someday, and you're going to want to work full-time, and when you do, you know, I'll have you come work full-time. I did, and then I eventually became general manager of the company for him, and I was there through the tube amps, the emulator, the STPG preamp, the tube amps, the tube microphones, the tube preamps, the tube compressor, the tube testing machine. So I was lucky enough to be a part of that. And so many of the people that I know in this industry are all because of him and what he did for me and my family.
Now, one of the things I want you to mention is the fact that we were talking a little bit before the show, and that was the innovation about the group to the matching tubes. You were talking about a testing machine. You know, I want you to go a little more into that.
He, you know, the first idea he had, I don't know how he figured out that matched tubes sounded better.
I think it was his hi-fi background.
Maybe, but how do you know that? Well, these,
because a lot of the hi-fi guys, even back then, were geeky into like, yep, making sure each tube drew the same amount of current.
Yeah, and he had those cool Macintosh. I mean, he had multiple Macintosh tube amps. He had great stereo system. He had like $10,000 Klipsch speakers. And that's like, so he got to, I don't know how he knew this guy, but there was this guy, and even Autumn couldn't remember his name, but I finally did after the service. His name was Hunt Dabney.
Okay.
And Hunt was down south, and he was building electronic hospital equipment. And he hired Hunt, and he had a couple of friends of his that invested with him. I don't remember them. I want to say Greg Smith, but I'm going to get the name wrong, so excuse me for that. But a couple guys invested. They paid Hunt, and he built this gigantic. It tested 36 or 32 power amp tubes. It was like, as long as you plug them in, computer screen. And we're talking in the mid, you know, late 70s here. Computer screen. Think about that, right? And it would show the different parameters. Not all of the parameters, but the ones that Hunt felt were the most important for matching tubes. And so later on, people, you know, other people like Mesa Boogie and started matching tubes and Antique Electronics, and they use some of those parameters and some other ones as well. But Aspen was definitely the first one. This was the power to matching system. And I think Fender was only doing low, medium, high, right? Aspen was 1 to 9.
But they have that Apex system now that Antique has. CE Distribution uses it to match all their output tubes.
So I think same, they're the respected ones right now, right? They have the best. And he would know because Don does so much work. So, but the 1 to 9 thing was really great because I've used all the different versions of those over the years. And I was lucky enough when Don and I were matching incredible tubes that would be vintage now. Like, oh,
it'd be a fortune.
Oh my God. I still have a bunch of old tubes that are matched by groove tubes you just can't get anymore. You know, KT66s and EL34s, Teslas, and and you know, American 6V6s, and
the Sylvanias and the RCAs that he had in Phillips.
The RCAs,
all of that stuff. Telefunkens, my Mullard rectifiers are nothing like a Mullard rectifier. I think to me, it's like it's just a rectifier, but you can hear the difference. Yeah. For us tube snobs, excuse me.
Tube sniffers.
Yeah, we are. I'm telling you. Like, I admit it. I'm telling you. I admit Don knows.
Yeah. I'm the same way, man.
I'll let somebody else speak to us. But like I said, Aspen took that and he ran with it. And it was a pleasure to talk to people on the phone back then when they'd call in. And he'd, I have a twin reverb. It just doesn't sound right. And Aspen used to say, 99% of the time, it's the tube. Back then, it was. Yeah. People didn't know. You'd go to the thrifty drugstore and you have a little tube tester and you'd put them in there.
That's what we all did. That just tells you if the tube turns on. That's about all it does.
And it was good or bad.
Our job was always to just get the people to try it because we knew they were going to love it. And once they did, so many people called back and said, oh my God, you've changed my life. My amplifier's fantastic now. It sounds so good. So that's what got the whole thing rolling, and the little teeny ads in the Guitar Player magazine. We're talking about tiny ads, and then in Vintage Guitar and stuff. So it was just fun being there through that whole period of time. And a big shout out to his number one guy, R.I.P. Paul Herman, who not only ran the shop while Ashman was gallivanting around the world, seriously, around the world hawking tubes, but raised Autumn, his daughter, who now runs Aspen Studio. And Autumn is, like I was just telling the guys, she is just chip off the old block.
Yeah.
And I don't see her doing anything but exactly the same thing as Aspen. She's probably going to have some great ideas coming up.
Well, that's great. No, to keep the legacy going. But that's good.
If anybody could, it's her. And she will.
And she has experience, too. She was at Guitar Center for a really long time. She was at, I think it was Elisa's. She was there. She went up the ranks in Elisa's, too. And finally, she grew out of that. She was like, hey, I can do my own thing.
Smart girl.
Yeah, she is a very, very sharp girl.
Then she moved to South America. And
she met her husband. He was the manager at Groove Tubes. At Guitar Center.
So, they, you know, I spoke with them, and they're closing up their house and moving back here to the States so that she can run the business.
And as great as Aspen was, his house is as eclectic as he is. That would be a trip to go with Autumn sometime and just go around the house and the history that's there of the House of Pain, the little room, and I'm sure it's all still there the same way. So it's,
what the House of Pain was a room with a souped-up front end of a super reverb.
Two of them.
So you could do two different tubes at the same. You'd put 12AX7 or a, you know, 7025 or a 12AU7, any of the 12 series preamp tubes, and you put them in there, wait for it to warm up, and ping on it, you know, with your fingernail, and see if it rang.
Now, we're talking about the hottest Mesa Boogie ever. So, you know how you can put an amp, if anybody who's had a tube amp like that, you put a bad tube in a Mesa Boogie and it starts going, making that noise. But we're talking about to the 10th power, this tester would do that. And so you could just ting it. It would go ting ting. That's why the House of Pain. So, a lot of the people would wear, you know, sound like you'd wear it at an airport. You'd wear those headphones.
Earmuffs.
But for us real rock and roll musicians, we didn't need no stinking headphones.
You got the tinnitus now to pay.
That's right.
Yeah. What'd you say?
What was that?
But it was fun. You know, it was a thing to do. And the place was just great. It was a great place to work. You talk to anybody who knows Groove Tubes from that era, from the 80s, even all probably into maybe even the early 90s, everybody wanted to go there. Everybody wanted to hang out. And you could just drop by Groove Tubes. And it would be like the hang. And he would be so welcoming.
Well, until like the mid-80s, he had it in his house.
And his house.
And then he moved over to Brantford in Pacoima.
That's the whole other story. He split it down the middle with Steve Robbie. And he had SWR on one side and Groove Tubes on the other. And That's a whole other era. But then he got the place.
Got the place on the corner of Arroyo and Foothill.
His mom won the lottery. Aspen's mom won the lottery. And she won like $275,000. And she didn't know what she was going to do with it. And Aspen said, give it to me. And he bought the house. He said, I'll pay you back with interest. And he did. And he bought the building. Oh. And even there, I mean, Eddie Van Halen stopped by. And I remember the first time he came out there, we'd been dealing with him. He opened the door of the van, and the smoke came out like a Cheech and Chong movie. It was hilarious. We were all laughing, and he was just so nice, and he was a great guy, and we all shared beers and stuff together, and like I said, and that was just one of like a billion artists that used to come out to Groove Tubes, because it was a fun place to be. You can't think of it. You can't go walking into Fender or Marshall or you know Mesa, but you can't go in there. You could just come to come to Groove Tubes and walk in, and all the amps would be stacked up, and he'd immediately start selling you something, you know, whatever his new thing was, right?
That's cool. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Janet would go, "What do you want?"
Now, Don, you worked with them even before that.
Right? I met Aspen in 1973. Wow. We worked at Acoustic. He was the West Coast regional sales rep and always had like some cool old car. You know, if it wasn't his, he'd borrow one from somebody. Like old, I want to say Model Ts because I don't really know old cars that well, but, you know, very similar, but they always looked, you know, cherried out.
Did he do just sales, or did he help in the design of the amps?
He did mainly sales. Steve Marks and Russell Lee and another guy named Madan Sharma were the ones that basically designed most of the stuff. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, towards the end there of Acoustic, I'd already left, but I know Steve Robbie, who, you know, started SWR after he left Acoustic, Steve helped design an amp that was basically a clone of a Boogie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really nice amp, but.
But even back then, was he into the tubes and design? Was there, what struck you about him in terms of what he was inventing or innovating?
Well, I don't think, I was there in 73 and 74. I think just his larger than life personality mm-hmm. is what struck me. And he was always like in a good mood and trying to make everybody else around him in a good mood,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, we're talking, you know, almost 50 years ago now. You know, doesn't seem that long.
And part of it, one of the things that he did that I will remember to this day is that he worked at Guitar Center for a while, and Acoustic was at its height when the Doors were playing Hollywood Bowl and the wall sound and all of that. And Aspen, when people used to come into the Guitar Center in Hollywood and they were interested in acoustic amps, he would immediately go over to the 360 bass amp, the Jocko amp, is what everybody knows it.
Yeah.
And he would turn the distortion on and pick up a bass, and he would play the Star Spangled Banner on the bass guitar at a really loud volume that would annoy the manager so much. But he sold a bunch of gear. And so that was, that's his larger than life personality.
Yeah, I was fortunate to see Jocko play with the Weather Report at the Hollywood Bowl for the Playboy Jazz Festival.
Wow.
And he had two acoustics.
Yeah.
And then he had an MXR digital delay that he used the chorus, and he got that sound. That's killer.
And he probably went home with Aspen. He's lived with Aspen on and off so many times in the house. He was just they just were buzz. You know, Jocko didn't like talking so much about music. He talked about all kinds of other stuff too. It's like, and he would just hang places. Like Jocko was at, our band was playing at the Glendale Holiday Inn, and he was there. And when we're doing covers, and it was embarrassing that we weren't playing something like really, really cool. And he comes up and he's so cool. And he's going like, "I really like you guys. You guys are really good. And can I help you out with your gear?" And I'm going like, "No, that's okay. Thanks." It's like, "You're Jocko." And the drummer's going like, "Sure." And so Jocko's carrying out drums to the car. I'm thinking, "Oh my God." It's like,
that's amazing.
It's just,
that's like Muddy Waters carrying in the Rolling Stones equipment. Exactly. 1964.
You know what?
on their first.
Well, we'll all admit the better you are, sometimes the better the musician is, the more down to earth and humble they really are.
True.
Just like they want to be like normal people. And
well, a lot of really great musicians. I mean, I met people through sessions. They were very, very cool and very normal. It wasn't like a lot of egos and stuff like that. In rock and roll, in bands that were playing a lot of the clubs at the time, I saw it more than I would see in the studio because you didn't have time. You were like in there, you had to do your stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty cut and dry, but it was pretty normal. But one of the other things that we were talking about, I'm going to bring up, and everybody, we'll get to the stereo, what's it called?
Center point.
SFX. In a minute. I'm holding off on Jonathan, but I'm going to get into that in a minute.
We love you.
But the other main thing, another thing that he did, I think before anybody else had done, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the speaker emulator. So tell me a little bit how that came about, if you remember, and what happened. Give me the story on that one.
Aspen, do you mind if I go first?
No, Michael, go ahead.
Aspen was a big vintage amp guy, and he knew all. When we were working there during the day, and we'd play gigs at night, but we were there during the day, we were all working there, and Paul Herman running the company, Aspen would come in every other day with some other incredible. Now we think back and go like, oh my God, you're bringing in a Blackface Deluxe. Oh my God, here's a Les Paul. Here's an L5. And that's where he made his friendship with Norm Harris of Norm's Rare Guitars, because he would go and just sell it to Norm, make a little bit of a profit, and Norm would then sell it for gigantic money. But he knew what great tone was. And I think that's what drew us together, is that we were both tone snobs, tone whores. You know, it's like it's just that sound that you would get when you have a real AC30 turned up. You can't get it from any other amp. That sound of a full stack turned up, the sound of a deluxe reverb or a super or a twin if you're playing clean and you want that, you know, that twang or the telly.
Or a Marshall combo.
Right, or a Marshall combo. If you were like, if you wanted to be Clapton and you wanted to do that, you have to do the male, the blues breaker thing. But he knew that sound, and he was going like, you can't have that sound. If you want that Marshall 100-watt sound, and you're playing at a club, how do you do that? He was back then thinking, you can't do that. And
that's even more true now, because almost any club you play at in this town anyway, if you're using more than a 15 or 20-watt amp, you'll get crucified.
One of the things I used to tell guys when they call in groove tubes back then, I was always to say, bring the right sized amp for the gig.
Yeah, don't bring a half stack.
Yeah, don't bring a half stack. Don't bring a 45-watt amp into a club, and you're never going to be able to get your sound. So Aspen decided that he was going to get these guys from Caltech and JPL and people that he knew through the industry and sound people from Hollywood all together, and he would come on over. He would pay them for their time. He would say, "I'm going to buy you a big dinner." He would have like. Bear Pit, his cousin Andy owned the Bear Pit here locally. Great barbecue food.
Yeah.
He'd buy Thai food. And like I said, the table was lined with really good alcohol, like scotch and stuff. You know, maybe they would smoke. You know, some guys would smoke. Most people didn't because they were all engineer types. But we would sit there. I would sit there, be quiet, and listen. It was incredible to listen to them. But he would say, this is what I want. And he would give them a demonstration of, I want to get this, but we want it to do this. And the hit and miss was really, really a lot. It was really hard for him to finally get the finished product because even though I was playing live, that was one way, but he went to studios with it. So he would give me one to play live to see if it would happen, and he would take it to studios and different places, and finally he got it tuned in. And I think it was Red that finally came up with the actual board that's inside of them. You can find that you can tweak with a little screwdriver to tweak the tonality of it, so you could plug your 100-watt Marshall in there and crank it up and plug it into a board, and it would, you know, or plug it into a small amp. You could take that 100-watt Marshall, plug it in the emulator, and go into a 20-watt amp. And as long as it was clean, it would just give that sound. But a great marketing point, and he didn't think about this in the long run. You're playing your wide amp on 10, and what's happening? You're burning up tubes. And who are you going to go to get more tubes?
Aspen.
You're going to call Groove Tubes to get your amplifier to sound right. So that was a twofold. He didn't think about that until after the fact. But it was
even if you were using a 100-watt amp, into a cabinet and it was on 10, it was still gonna right. worked those tubes pretty hard. But I think the emulator worked them just a little bit harder.
Yeah.
But the hardest thing that I remember was getting the tonality right. Well, you know, because it's easy to step down the output of an amp.
Right.
But the hard part is getting it to sound right.
The reactive load, as they call it, the reaction between the speaker and the tubes. Because right. you have the preamp, the power tubes going into the transformer, going into the speakers. That's it. That's your final three stages right there.
Yeah.
To get that happening there, man. I think it took him the longest to develop the emulator, and that's what I think disturbed him the most when that design was, you know, pilfered by other people, you know, that I mentioned earlier. But he got a lawsuit for it, and he won, but it cost him a lot of money.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about the different amps and, like, playing combos in clubs and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my friends were using 50 watts or 100 watt Marshalls, and we were talking about great tone. And one album to me that stands out all the time is Rockin' the Fillmore Humble Pie.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a 100 watt head with a 4x12 cabinet. But I noticed with the 100 watts, it was much punchier than the 50 watt. The 50 watt broke up faster and it got more of a creamy sound.
Well, yeah.
But
that's
you couldn't get that punch. Like when you hear Stone Cold Fever, it's in your face on that album.
Well, listen to the Allman Brothers live at the Fillmore.
Oh, yeah.
Dwayne used 50 watt heads
right.
into two cabinets. Dickie used one 100 watt head into two cabinets. And Dickie always liked a cleaner sound anyway. But you know, Dwayne would just roll everything to 10 and go.
We're thinking about the classic tonalities that have come out from just what we're talking about, those Marshalls. When you think about Humble Pie or Clapton back with the Cream days, Hendrix, you know, with its 100-watt Marshalls. Now getting more modern. Eddie Van Halen and his 100 watt, which I was lucky enough to know Eddie from Aspen and saw them at rehearsal one time in Burbank, and he had the full 5150 stacks, and we were there because we were doing the tube mics and walked behind the amplifiers, and there's the 100 watt head, and that's where the cable is running. The cable is running to the 100 watt Marshall into the cab.
Right.
So he was really, Eric Johnson, right? Another guy with incredible.
I used to see Eric when I lived in Corpus Christi, Texas. He had a band called the Electromagnets, and they used to come down. He would have a packing blanket over the cabinet.
Yeah. When he played at NAMM, he had the Dumble hit in the back. He was using the Dumble. He wasn't using the Marshall.
That's a whole another. Next time I come in, we'll talk about Dumble.
Yeah. But the other thing, though, too, is besides, like, for you're talking about Hendrix. Like the classic album Band of Gypsies, he's getting, when you hear him play, he's got the fuzz face, but he has like a clean sound maybe at about 5 or 6, so it just crunches when he digs into it.
Yeah,
that Hendrix is playing. But when you listen to him and he starts playing like some little blues riffs, he's using it fairly clean. He's dialed it down, but it's the sustain, it starts feedbacking cleanly. He starts getting clean feedback.
Yeah,
the problem is you can't get that. It's a physical thing. It's physics. It's the loudness going in and feedback picking. Even though it's clean, it's not just full blown. Like Van Halen later, when he started using the 5150s, a lot of that's the preamp is designed to get all that gain.
Right.
But it's different. And that tone that he would get using the wah-wah or just using the different pickups that Hendrix would get, a lot of that tone is the guitar clean, but such gain that it sustains forever. You know what I'm saying?
But when you step on a fuzz face and roll the volume back on your guitar a little bit, it cleans up and gets a little brighter.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
You know, most pedals won't do that.
Yeah.
You know, plus he had that Univibe on Bandit.
The Univibe was...
That was like brand new.
I had a comment that by far, Band of Gypsies was my favorite Hendrix thing. I mean, you got Electric Leyland, incredible. You know, oh my God, you know, Are You Experienced? Bold as Love. Yeah, they're all incredible. But there was something about the soulfulness of Band of Gypsies that night, those two nights that they both nights they played. He was in this great mood because I saw him at Devonshire Downs here when I was really young. He was not in a great mood. He just didn't, he just didn't really want to play. But that night there, that New Year's Eve, man, he was something
else. He was happening. It was one of those magic moments.
It was. And he had the tone. And that's Another thing about having a great amplifier, we're talking about that tone, is turning the guitar down. You turn the guitar down and it gets clean, and you go up a little bit more and get a little more bite, and then you go up and it would be biting hard, and then you can hit that. He'd hit that fuzz face, or he could hit the wah-wah pedal and go, bang, and it would just take people's head off. Yeah. Like that.
But that turning the amp up and then just bringing the amp up, the guitar, I call it bloom. You just get a little bit of this distortion, but it's a really nice, smooth sound. And one of the things I remember when I had RCAs when I got my Bandmaster. Like, I mean, they lasted forever. And they finally went out, and then I went and got the groove tubes. The thing I noticed with the groove tubes, the smoothness of the tone, especially in the preamp tubes, there was harshness, and I didn't like Sylvanias a lot because they would get kind of harsh and spiky at the time.
If you want a really great, clean sound, the Sylvanias were real good. But if you wanted warm, RCAs.
Yeah, but I noticed that the groove tubes were very, very, by getting the match set or whatever, it just was really smooth. It just had that smoothness.
Can we just jump back for a second for the people that are watching or going to watch that may not know? People still talk about groove tubes being tubes. They are not tubes. Groove tubes is a process of taking tubes and matching them. So when you say I'm buying groove tubes, are you buying Chinese groove tubes? Are you buying Russians? Are you buying test Czechoslovakian? That's right. USA from the old days. It was taking whatever was being made at the time and matching them. And that's why those old matched groove tubes, the USA Phillips 6V6s or the,
the old Mollards.
Mollards
and Siemens. I remember he still had Siemens into the mid-90s for EL34s.
I still have a couple of sets of the color tubes that I won't use just because they're colored. EL34s that he had colored red or blue with a gold printing on them. And you can't buy them, and they probably would sound fantastic. But but groove tubes was a process.
Process. So he was getting, but now.
He would buy tubes from
Russian tubes.
Curated tubes.
Yeah.
But the different countries that were making the tubes, is there a difference? I mean, was he, by his quality control, was he able to get a consistency that it didn't matter which groove tube you bought? Well, did you have to look for, like, the Russian?
Broke it down into different ones. I'd say the last 10 years that Aspen owned groove tubes, you had the Chinese 12AX7, you had the Russian 12AX7, which is just a Sovtek. You had the Yugoslavian 12AX7, which were great 12AX7s.
They also made an ECC-83. On the preamps, where they were not the same.
No, each one had its own personality.
The best Chinese 12AX7 was by far the highest gain, best tube you could get. Because we went through them and it was like, wow, why does this sound so good in that first section? But the quality of failure of them was much higher to get those few.
Yeah.
You know, so he had to pay. And then we, at that time back then, we would sell them off to, I think it was DOD. They were all located in Utah or something.
Yeah.
And we would sell off all of the tubes that failed. They were fine as long as you weren't using them in a high-gain section. They'd be fine. So he sold them off, Mr. Salesman sold them off for more than he paid for them. So he made money even on the tubes that didn't work for him.
I used to buy, when I was at SWR, I used to buy skids of, you know, 12 AX7s.
Don't you still have them? Don't you still have some?
Yeah.
I have two boxes of 112.
I don't have two boxes, but
and I have the same thing with the from Tesla, which you can't get anywhere. I have 6L6s from Tesla, but two boxes. They're not tested. They're not tested and matched, but that quality at that time was really, really good. And that's the sad thing about tubes right now, is that, you know, another whole story about Aspen trying to, his one goal later in life was he wanted to make really good tubes. And I think it was Norm, when I was talking to him at the service, he was saying, why don't we, Larry Thomas. Larry Thomas, the CEO of Guitar Center and Fender. One of them was telling me that they were talking to Aspen about doing the tube thing again.
Yeah.
I remember Hartley Peavy wanted to do it. But there's just to do it here in the USA, you know, with all of the environmental.
Well, I hooked him up with my dad, of all people, because my dad knew everybody in business in L.A., in Southern California. And he tried to set Aspen up with a number of different people so he could manufacture tubes. But if you remember, the only thing they couldn't do was blow the glass because that 20,000-gallon propane tank about 100 feet across the street.
Fire the building. Went, you're right.
No.
And then he opens a studio, and there's a railroad track, you know, like another 100 feet behind that goes by. How can you have a recording studio with a train going by all the time? No, but that was it when he wanted to do it, too. He was very serious about it, and to this day, I'm still friends with the guy that he hired from the Midwest, a guy named John James, a really super nice guy, really intelligent, worked with Charles, with the, who made the big KT, the big tubes?
KT-88?
I think it's a hi-fi.
What is it?
Yeah, the big hi-fi tube. Anyway, so
he was working with 803 or?
Yeah, those guys, and they're still being made.
Well, 301.
Well, speaking of hi-fi, let me, this is a little tangent, but I want to ask you about this. Amps like some of the audiophile amps, and especially like Macintosh, what do you use for those? Can you get quality tubes, or does it matter in a hi-fi amp?
No, it does matter.
Big time.
As one who owns three old Fisher point-to-point stereos.
And is there more leeway in the tubes because you're not pushing them as hard as...
That's the other thing.
Yeah.
You're not pushing like you would for a distortion guitar.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's a totally different, you know... Where a guitar, you want the thing to break up eventually. With hi-fi, you want everything to stay clean as long as you can get it.
Yeah, but I wonder where Macintosh gets
Well, you're looking for even order for us as guitar players. We're looking for even order harmonics. Those are the ones that make that sound that you're like, oh, my God, listen to that singing sound.
Well, there's, you know, with Macintosh, there's some really good KT-66s on the market. Valve Art makes them, and...
Where are they originally from? Are they from Europe?
They were from Movalve in London, England.
Oh.
They were the only place, because Movalve invented the KT-66 and the KT-77 and the, no, they didn't do the EL-37, that was Muller, but the KT-66 was invented, kinkless tetrode is what it stood for. And they were trying to get the kink out of the certain aspect of the gain. You know, as it, you know,
for clean up,
sound. It's got like a slope.
Yeah.
It's all for clean.
But well,
tubes were always originally designed for clean.
Guitar players were the ones torturing the tubes and driving the engineers nuts. Right?
I remember reading a Fender manual when I was probably 12 or 13. It says, be careful not to turn the volume up too far or the amp will go into distortion. Isn't that what you want?
When we
the guys in the lab coats didn't think so in those recording studios.
Yeah. Leo Fender brought Red Rhodes when he was playing at the Palomino, and they were very good friends. Brought him one of the first twins, and he's going like, "What is wrong with this?" And Red's going like, "It's distorted. It's never going to work." Because Red was a pedal steel player, didn't want any distortion. You wanted that clean, incredible sound, and he was like, "And this is what brought the into its." Big power. They were getting like 50 watts out of it. He's going like, it's not right. And then they finally got it up to 85. And that's when that was a great story, too. Red was here. He could embellish that story.
Ultra linear output transformers.
But Red had, I heard about him. He had that little Princeton that was hot rodded to like 60 watts or something.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, I want one of those.
Red was my mentor.
Hold on. Oops. Sorry. But anyway, he had gone ahead and little amp was so powerful and clean.
Yeah,
it was so clean.
Yeah, and then Aspen realized that in making guitar amplifiers, to get a certain sound, and I guess nobody really played on this, was the voltage of the power transformer driving the tubes, and how the higher voltage would get a really spanky sound, and that's what was known with the AC-30, super high voltage, and Aspen was running like, I think, on some of those early solos, they were running 525 volts, which is,
yeah,
is okay if you have American tubes, but Russian and Chinese tubes, you'd be burning tubes out once a week.
Well, even the early Music Man amps were running the plate voltage at 570.
Wow.
Or, no, I'm sorry, not 5700.
And remember, Matchless was doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And then they had their amps.
But not on the DC
super,
anymore.
Super high. I remember talking to Mark Sampson about him and calling and saying, people want to buy tubes. They want to know what they can do, you know. And so this is the problem was that tubes were becoming obsolete, you know, as guitar players didn't really want, you know, they wanted to move on to electronic or whatever, line six or other stuff then. So the demand for tubes being made was just going downhill.
Well, look at Box and Standell in the early 60s, both started with, you know, transistor amps.
Yeah.
I used to have a hybrid Standell amp that was a FET front end with a tube output section.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tell you.
Well, that was Music Man. It was a solid state preamp and power amp.
You know, in 1962, Stan Held did.
And I know you still play out a lot, and I play out a lot, but I always carry, and probably this day still do, carry a spare amp when I'm out, because you never know if a tube's going to go out or something, and you don't have time on stage. And to me, that's the immediate, like a ball of sweat if your amp goes out. It's different if a guitar string breaks. Oh, I can just change or play around it, but your amp goes out.
I carry a box of spare tubes.
I do too.
I carry a PV solid state amp. And why? It can use it for the bass guitar, the keyboard, the PA, you know, for my guitar amp, for whatever it is. It'll cover for anybody in the band. And so PV stuff was always really very roadworthy, but it wasn't like for me, like the end-all, be-all tone, you know. It's the big three, Vox, Marshall, and Fender. Yeah. And everything else is kind of like, oh, well, that's close to that.
Everybody else emulates those three. Now,
I'm saying that, and I'm an orange guy.
There you go.
So I'm sorry about that.
But, okay, we're running out of time, so I want to make sure we talk to Jonathan. I wanted to talk a little bit about your involvement with him, and then you have one of the CenterPoint systems.
Right, I brought that with me. Well, actually, I didn't like work for Aspen, but I've known him, you know, in different capacities. I mean, it started off when I was a kid in boarding school. I didn't know Aspen the man, but I knew it's like he marketed everybody just to like geek out on tubes. You know what I mean? It's almost like, oh, the little ad you were talking about in Guitar Player magazine. I was one of the kids answering that ad, and I would get the nice literature, the big Aspen envelope. Everything was warm and fuzzy. It was beautiful. Made me want to get new tubes badly. I had either my Princeton's or my I think I had a 200 watt 71 that was modified to one of those poor man boogie circuits where you had the dual gains on it, and it was like but it's going to sound better if I get groove tubes. And so that. But then, you know, as things went into the 90s, I got involved in the actual business end of things and being in retail stores that carried his stuff. The last 8 years when I was working in a brick-and-mortar place was in the Y2Ks, and of course I was right down the street from Aspen's shop, which was Castle's Music. And, in fact, they have one of those tube testers you're talking about way in the dusty back, you know, those little things you'd get at the supermarkets back in the early 70s. But, and I, you know, I got to know Aspen in a different way as a friend, as a mentor, and he was a fan of my instrument, which is the Toga Man guitar viol that it's a kind of a Jimmy Page on steroids kind of thing, it's, you know. And he would have me demo at the NAMM show. In fact, he would loan me amps when I did have a booth, and particularly the one I've brought with me, which is the CPS, which is CenterPoint Stereo. And that's kind of a later stripped down version of what he did with the Fender, which was this SFX. Same, you know, speaker layout concept, but
go ahead and grab the cabinet and explain the difference between the SFX and where this was the next generation, right?
This evolved. Yes, this is his post
go ahead and bring Fender. Just grab it.
I'm going to get my jacket off here for a second. I was kind of freezing.
SFX Aspen started SFX this was one of the later products he did with a guy named Drew Daniels that's passed away. Mm-hmm. Drew was an engineer, really super smart guy. And as you can't really see, but the speakers in here are facing One's facing this way, one's facing this way.
And Aspen would say that one exhales or inhales this way and exhales that way.
Yeah, and there's a speaker right there.
And they're out of phase.
Kind of push-pull.
Can you lift it up a little bit so they can see it on the camera?
Yeah.
There it is there.
I mean, that camera.
Now, does this have any amplifier built in?
It does.
Okay, is it just a power amp?
It's just a power amp.
It's called the space station.
So there's a speaker that's pointing to the side, and then there's another speaker pointing directly out. And the one to the side is that a horn or something?
It's just a cutout.
Lift it up for a second.
It's a port.
Okay. All right. So let's turn it around for a second and show it to that camera.
Okay. I'll show the backside here so you can see what this is.
See the controls.
And you can also see.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Okay, so what exactly was he doing?
Yours is for $29.95.
So first of all, before we get into that, what was SFX? What was the main thing about
it? It was surround sound for musical instruments.
So he just had the speakers pointing around.
Except you didn't have to have four speakers in four corners like you do in your house. You can just plug this in right here and play a keyboard or a guitar through it, and the sound would be coming. Because it's reflecting and out of phase, it would sound like it's coming from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it was really cool. It was so over-the-top, brand new. Yeah. Nobody had ever done it before, like many of Aspen's things. You know, Fat Finger and Fat Head. And,
what he did was essentially take the studio process of taking the two mics and kind of putting the out-of-phase kind of thing going on. You know, like how Jim Morrison's vocals were recorded, that kind of stuff. And he said he took it on the amp end with the speakers and took the same concept. But then, you know, into one thing. Now, the SFX that was with the Fender, it had kind of the built-in chorus and everything, so you had a little bit of something in there. This is kind of stripped down without that, so your caveat with this amp for it to work right is to have kind of a stereo rig of some kind. So whether it's a... you know, one of those multi-effects or just anything that's stereo. Like, I like throwing, like, a ping pong delay in this thing and stuff like that, and it's real funky and groovy.
So the center point stereo, what improved from the, or what was the next step from the SFX?
Well, that's what, I think his post-Fender years and after he sold the company, he wanted to still keep marketing this particular amp, but he wanted... to make it such that it's a real, very professional, sturdy unit, and you could actually bring your own. Let's say, for example, you've got a little mixing board, and you want to play in a little, you know, maybe a duo or a trio or something like that, in a small little, like a wine bar or something like that, wants to put out some sound, not be so painfully loud, but be heard all over the room, and that's what this thing does. The big problem with like stereo, like when you have a PA system where you have left and right, you're just nailing those people in those very spots. And unless you're in the sweet spot of the room, you're not getting the full stereo effect. Right. This thing, you can be in any point of the room, anywhere, it's an even sound. And here's a funny one that and Aspen and I have talked about this. When he loaned me one for the NAMM show, I had a booth there like, it was 2005, I think. And... the NAMM police were, you know, the people with the DB meters were walking around. And they were flustered because it was at the right DB sound pressure level, but they're going, how in the heck were they getting the sound anywhere they walked around? It was just spreading out so efficiently.
It wasn't like there was 120 dB coming right here.
No.
They couldn't get...
And they couldn't give you a warning.
They couldn't
shut it down.
Right. So it was like they were puzzled. They couldn't get it. Now this is like, you know, we were talking about tube amps and things like that and guitars and overdrives. That's not what this amp does. What this amp does is just give you a really good way of taking a stereo-based...
So any distortion or tone you're deriving from whatever.
Yeah, you could put a Marshall JMP1 into this thing and get, you know, Billy Gibbons sound, and it could be SFX.
Right. Now, the caveat, though, is it has to be a stereo thing because it's mono, it's just going to sound.
What happens when you stack those? Does that work really well? Or
stack these amps on top?
Like if you had like three of them.
I guess
it would
most likely work. I haven't tried it, but what this thing does is you can put like a subwoofer. You can put this over a subwoofer cabinet just so you can get your subwoofer going.
Yeah.
And there's an actual I think, yeah, there's an out sub thing right here. So if you have your CPS level and width, which is basically, it's just the speakers individually. Yeah. I know it's kind of fancy talk for that. It's kind of like a presence knob, you know, it's kind of a different thing.
I think he brought this to the app show.
Producer switch.
And he was bugging me that he wanted to demonstrate this, but, you know, on the stage, we had seminars scheduled in the morning and the afternoon. He said, Lonnie, I really want to show this off. I go, well, why don't you just get your own demo room? He goes, no, I want to do it on the big stage in front of people and so they can really hear it. I go, I really don't think we have time. But he talked me into it. He was so adamant about promoting this thing that I had to cave. But
great,
I made a deal with him. I said, I'll let you do it, but you got to give me a day's recording time in your studio. And he was like, oh, yeah, okay. So I actually went and recorded it in the studio, which was a great, you know, two songs in there.
For the people that want to know, Aspen's studio is still running. His daughter's still running it.
Right.
And it's called Aspen's Place. Go online, look it up. Everything in there is tubes. It's the museum of tube stuff, but all the gear that you would record into is tubes. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point I was making, though, was that you have your inputs left and right, okay? And then you have a sub out, which means that if you have a subwoofer down below, you can kind of add that to it. Now, there is a bigger sister model to this thing, which he reached out to me back in January, and unfortunately I haven't had to have at it, but it's a, you know, bigger, beefier, stronger, louder version of it.
Bigger drivers, or?
I think just more juice.
Okay.
More.
But the one that I have, the Fender one that I have, has all of this in it. It's like 215s, and they're offset just like that, and it's got three independent channels, and you have the SFX, and you have all of these different effects that you can or cannot add.
Yeah.
And like he said, if I play a bar with my wife and we're just doing a duo and I'm playing an acoustic guitar, you think back into the like 60s where everybody would plug into one amp. The bass, the guitar, the keyboards would be into one amp.
Right.
But I'm plugging my guitar in, and she's plugging a microphone in, could be wireless or whatever, and it sounds like we're playing through separate amplifiers. It's not jumbled. It's just completely clear.
Yeah,
it's just awesome, man. It was just a great idea.
That's amazing. I heard it at the memorial, and it was impressive. Yeah. The equipment.
And Bose tried to copy it to a degree with their S1 that came out.
Right, they don't have the same.
No.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're talking about guitar things. It's not for the rock and roll. You're not looking. This is not Hendrix-y or it could be if you're playing clean.
Well,
if you're using
a pedal system.
If you're using something up, you need to have a front end on this thing. What I like about it is it's very flat response.
Right.
And for what I do, it's important. I know it sounds weird. I'm talking about Bow guitars here for a second, but when you're distorting an amp, you're getting effectively what people were trying to do with a violin bow. You're getting that cello bow kind of thing. You're getting the sustain. Yeah. You're getting the whole feedback. Well, that's with a bowed instrument, that's already there. So it's almost like taking a distortion box and a distortion box, piling them on, and it's just going to be mush.
Yeah.
You lose your definition. Well, what I like about this is I can get a pretty straight up sound, and I can control how much of that crazy stuff. If I want to throw in a little overdrive, why not? You know,
you may want to try the Origin Effects Revival Drive, because that's basically like any tube amp with a little tweaking in the world, and it's all analog.
Is it stereo?
No.
The thing about this is you have to run stereo to really get it.
Right,
gentlemen, we're out of time.
No
I told
way.
You it would go by fast, but I real quick, I want Lonnie to talk.
Don't we get another hour?
No.
Come on.
And a couple of, I need you to talk.
I drank all this Dunkin' Donuts coffee. I'm all wired up, and now I can't even talk.
I need you to talk a little bit about what's coming up in a couple of weeks, the Amp Show.
Yeah, the 15th annual L.A. Amp Show is coming up.
Jeez.
It's October 12th and 13th. The same hotel, the Airtel Plaza Hotel in Van Nuys. And private demo rooms, different companies coming in to show you, the public, what they're doing. And we're giving away pedals. We're giving away amps.
They give away a lot of stuff. It's worth it.
Yeah, didn't you? Yeah. You won.
I won an amp.
Didn't you win the, who won the Velvet Elvis painting? Was that you?
Yes, I did. I did.
But, you know, we always have some fun to do.
Right, but yeah. Something about his show that's better than any show. When you go into a room and you're playing a 100-watt Marshall, you can play a 100-watt Marshall at 100 watts. You can turn the thing all the way up.
We give
there's
away,
no NAMM police.
And we give
no
away earplugs for free. And you, there's no sound limit, you know, as
and you're walking
as you
around.
Can stand it.
Yes, I'll be there on the 13th, and I'm doing I'll be hosting a panel. The bass panel. So come on down and say hi. We'll be there.
You never know who you'll run into.
Oh, there's a rumor that Joe Bonamassa
he'll be there. You
and
know that.
Elliot Easton both might appear on
Zach,
Sunday.
Zach Wilde's showing up. Billy Gibbons is showing up.
All these guys show up. But Jimi Hendrix will not make it.
No, Jimi Hendrix won't.
No, will Jaco. But, you know, Aspen did bring Jaco to my old LA guitar show.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And let's do this again. We didn't even cover some of the other things that he invented. So we have to do this again. I thank you all.
Next year.
Everybody have a great day, great week. We'll see you next week.
Happy New Year.
Bye.